This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week we'll be asking how helpful labels like chitlit and manlit really are when it comes to choosing a book to read. Tony Parsons tells us how he feels about being dubbed the father of manlit.
I don't like any labels at all because I think they're all so broad as to be almost meaningless.
Gail Honeyman talks to Robert about how she hopes to transcend the genre boundaries with her debut novel.
As Eleanor opens herself up to new experiences and to meeting new people, she starts to make connections and things change so much for her.
And I get educated in the world of the Victorian sensation novel, in which men were powerful and strong, while women were supposed to be prim and proper. That's all coming up in today's show. Rock journalist, newspaper columnist, TV broadcaster and best-selling author, Tony Parsons has been them all. In a career spanning 5 decades, he continues to reflect on modern life from street level rather than from the lofty ideals that we so often fail to live up to. Since the overnight success of Man and Boy in the year 2000, his books have given the male point of view on parenthood, relationships and heartbreak, and shown that even middle-aged boys can cry. More recently, he's reinvented himself as a crime writer, beginning with The Murder Bag, which Lee Child described as spectacular. With the fourth book in the series out now, and the sequel to Man and Boy about to enter the Talking Books library, I was delighted when Tony Parsons invited me round for a cup of tea and to talk about his life as a writer. Tony, welcome to Read On Air.
Thanks for having me.
So, rereading Man and Boy, I was struck by just how little things have changed and how pertinent it is. Do you think much has changed being a male parent in the last 17 years?
I don't think so. I mean, it's quite old, that book now. You know, as you say, it's knocking on for its 20th anniversary. And I think, if anything, the themes of the book have become more relevant. I mean, I wrote it at the time when my mother was dying and my son was growing up fast. And for the first and really the last time in my life, I felt poised between two generations. I felt very much somebody's son and somebody's father. I felt really, you know, part of the sandwich generation. And I think as people's parents are living longer, And maybe their children are staying at home longer, the sandwich generation has increased in bandwidth over those last 20 years. So I think it's, I mean, there was a big gap between the man my father was. He was a World War II veteran and very much an old school patriarch, and the kind of guy that I was and my experiences of growing up in a time of peace and prosperity and sex and drugs and rock and roll. But I think there's less of a gap now between the parents of today and their children. So I think it's, you know, it was a book that I wrote really as therapy when my mum was dying of cancer, and it was my way of dealing with her illness and losing her. And I think its themes are pretty much universal and timeless.
And I think your protagonist, Harry Silver, his father is a very dignified man. And actually, Harry only really achieves dignity after the loss of his father. It's almost as if he has to undergo that suffering to realise exactly what life is.
My father and his generation had a kind of enforced maturity. And if anything, we're encouraged to stay adolescents these days until we're about 50 or beyond, you know, the Jeremy Clarkson genes that we squeeze our aging bodies into. So I think but life has a way of making you grow up. You know, like, you can't really duck that stuff. You can't duck the hard stuff.
When I first read the book, I'd just become a new father. And what I loved is that there was a male voice articulating my thoughts. And I know that you have been dubbed the father of manlit, but I think it goes deeper than that. Does the manlit label bother you at all?
Yeah, I don't like any labels. I don't like any labels at all because I think they're all, you know, they're all so broad as to be almost meaningless. I mean, I can understand, you know, the need for them. But I just, I'm not a big fan of labels because I think that, you miss out on something when you're reading labels when you could be actually reading the book, maybe.
And a lot of people thought that Man and Boy was your first novel, but actually I think you wrote your first novel, The Kids, in 1976?
Yeah, I left school at 16 and I knew I wanted to write and I thought if I wrote a novel and got it published, then I would certainly, nobody could dispute the facts that I was a writer. So, most books, as you know yourself, it's largely an act of will. It's like they're like, writing a book is like running a marathon. It's really, of course talent is helpful, as Hemingway said, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is getting through it. The main thing is going back to your desk day after day for a long time. And even a short book takes a long time to write. So I wrote I was working in Gordon's Gin Distillery, which is the factory that Gordon's Gin, very famous gin manufacturer, of course, they used to have on the City Road in Islington. And I worked there before my first job in journalism, and I worked on the night shift. So we were largely unsupervised for 12 hours at night, from 8 o'clock at night to 8 o'clock in the morning. They would fill us full of free gin and then just let us loose for 12 hours. And there was a lot of downtime. There was a lot of free time. And I used that to write my novel. And it really wasn't a very good book. It was quite a poor book. It was kind of typical of the kind of stuff that you write when you're young and, gets left in a drawer somewhere. But the difference with me was that, I was very, I'm not sure if ambition is the right word, but I was just determined to push it through, to push it all the way to the end of the process. So I wrote the book, and the toughest thing was finding an agent. That was harder than the agent finding a publisher. So it took years, it took years from the initial writing of the book to finding an agent to getting it published. But it eventually got published, and that got me my first job in journalism. And I had no idea about the economics of books. I thought, I'd have enough money to live, on my own private island somewhere in the Caribbean if I had a book published. And of course it was like that. I got 700 quid for it. But I always had this feeling, I just felt in my blood and my bones, that if I got a book published, then I would always be a writer. And funny enough, it did turn out like that because it got me my first job in journalism, and then everything led on from that. Because it was quite impressive to when the NME advertised for new writers and people were sending in their little, biro scribbled Bruce Springsteen reviews or their little chippy tappy typewriter reviews of Patti Smith, and I sent them a published book. So they didn't read it, They didn't need to read it. It was just, wow, this guy in the gin distillery has got a book published. And so it was quite impressive because, a lot of them, they haven't had a book published now, 40 years later. So it was quite impressive. But it is, I think I always understood that it was largely an act of will, and it is that for, for aspiring writers. I think, it's always important to remember that it's just, digging in. You have to just keep going and not put off. I mean, classic example is J.K. Rowling, who was, turned down by a dozen publishers in London. I mean, everything, the smart money would have said, this is not for you. Think of something else. Stop. You're just inflicting misery on yourself. Give it up. And she didn't give it up. And that's why she's changed children's literature and made billions and, changed the face of popular fiction. So it's largely just digging in and keeping going. And I think I understood that early on. I think because I came from a background where people didn't have careers, they had jobs. My family, my dad was a greengrocer. Nobody had careers in my family. They had jobs. And so I didn't expect it to be easy. I never expected the world to be waiting for me or waiting to read my book. I knew that it was probably going to be much tougher than that.
And do you have those days where you sit in front of the word processor and nothing comes out? Or are you a fortunate writer who always manages to get something down on paper?
Yeah, I mean, I think I understand, Hemingway, who's very good on the self-help for writers. Hemingway says you should always leave something in the well meaning that, you know, when I go to my desk tomorrow, I know I've got something to work on. I've got something to work on. There's something in the well already to draw on. So even on the worst of days, you can get started. You can make a go of it. And, you know, you can't really have writer's block and make a living out of it. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work if you can get nothing out. So you have good days and bad days. And you know, I'm quite a long way into my career now. I've been doing this for a while. And so I know that there are going to be hard days. I know that there are going to be difficult times when you need to drag it out. But, I mean, over the last few years, I've been writing a book a year for the last 5 years. And you do understand the techniques to make it work. You know that you learn the best time of day to write. You know the conditions that you want to write in. You know how much exercise you need, how much fresh air you need. You know, putting good things into your body, and you know, just having a good attitude to it, not being too down when it's tough, when it's hard, and those moments you hit a brick wall. Just, you know, learn for ways to get around that brick wall. You know, you learn these things with time, I think. You know, they're hard-earned lessons. So I do have very tough days, and I do have days where I have longer than days, like weeks and months, where I think this book is not where it needs to be. But the thing is, I can recognise that it's not where it needs to be. It's not as good as I want it to be. It's not the book that's in my head and in my heart. It's not that book. The book that I've got on page is weaker than that. It's more mediocre than that. So I know I've got to put the hours in, and I'm always ready to put the hours in. You know, I'm always ready to put the time in.
One of the other things that I admire about you is that you're not afraid to reinvent yourself. I was going to ask you whether there's Harry Silver Becomes a Grandfather book ahead, but also you've left Harry Silver for a bit and you've moved to crime fiction.
Yeah, I was at a screening in 2010 and things were kind of winding down for me with the, you know, post Man and Boy. I mean, it was such an enormous success, and it was this kind of success that any writer dreams of, you know, kind of commercial success that any writer dreams of. And you can never regret that or be sad that it happened. But it does push your career in a certain direction, which you wouldn't necessarily have gone in. And I wouldn't necessarily, if Man and Boy had just sold reasonably, I wouldn't necessarily have written more books about families and relationships and all that stuff. Probably wouldn't have done it. I'd probably done something completely different. But because it made so much money for so many people and it sold so many millions of copies, I was kind of, you know, locked into that for a good 10 years. You know, you're locked into it. You just sort of picked up by the momentum of it, and also it's scary when you get off the roller coaster, because, you know, I said to my agent a few years ago, what I really want to write is thrillers. I want to write thrillers with heart, and he said, well, he said, I think you do that well. And he's a very honest man. He said, but you're going to have to start again. And what he meant was, you know, I'd need a new publisher. I'd need a publisher to choose me again. He didn't spell it out for me, but it seemed to me obvious that I'd need to write it without a contract. So I would need to, you know, cash in my life savings. I'd need to gamble all that money, all the money that I'd accumulated. I'd have to invest that in myself, because you can't, if my old publisher had published it half-heartedly or kind of indulging me, it would have been the kiss of death. It would have definitely failed. It would have definitely failed. And I couldn't afford to do that. I needed it to be a success. And it was really, I was at a screening in 2010, and it was a screening organised by Sam Mendes, who had written to me about Man and Boy, how much he liked Man and Boy. And I don't know Sam Mendes, but we kind of stayed in touch, and he invited me to this screening of a film called The Kids Are All Right, which is a small film that he felt people weren't going to see, and he felt that more people should know about it. It wasn't a film that he was involved in, although it starred Annette Bening, who was in American Beauty, of course. And we were just having a glass of wine, and what are you doing, what are you up to? And he said, oh, next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to direct the next James Bond movie, which, of course, you know, 7 years on, with hindsight, seems like a good career move for Sam Mendes, because he did it so brilliantly. But at the time, it was, wow, you know, the director of American Beauty and the Donmar Warehouse doing James Bond, that's a bit of a shock. And he started talking about how much he'd loved the Ian Fleming books when he was a kid. And, Yeah, and how important they'd been to him. And he was going to try and capture whatever it was he loved in those books, because he didn't think it had ever been done before. And I knew exactly what he meant. You know, I knew exactly what he meant, because I'd loved those books too. And, you know, nothing in Roger Moore or James Bond or any of the, even Sean Connery, nothing had captured the essence, that kind of gritty essence in the Ian Fleming books. So he said, my preparation for this film is I'm going to reread all the books and just try and capture that. And I came home that night and I thought, what a wonderful thing for a middle-aged man to do, to reread all those terrific books again. I'm going to do that. And I picked up a copy of Casino Royale. By the time I was off the first page, I knew that I wanted to write a serious hero. I knew I wanted to have a crack at creating a hero of my own. And because it just seems to me that, you know, we don't think of Ian Fleming as a great writer, but it seems we don't think of Arthur Conan Doyle as a great writer, or Agatha Christie, or Raymond Chandler. Maybe Raymond Chandler we do. But the people that have created Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson and James Bond and Philip Marlowe and Jack Reacher, we don't think of them as like the supreme writers, but there's something incredible about creating a hero that still means something 100 years later. So I thought I wanted a crack at it. I just felt that this is the thing that I'd really love to do now. And, you know, I discussed it with Yuriko, discussed it with my wife. You know, it would mean cashing in my savings. It would mean gambling that. And so it was... And giving myself the time to do it right, because I knew I needed a couple of years really to do the first one. And it was kind of scary. I mean, I'd lost my job as a newspaper columnist at the Daily Mirror after 18 years. I lost that just as I was completing the book. So kind of everything ended. Suddenly everything ended, you know. And certainly, you know, when Man and Boy came out and was number one, and you just kind of think, oh, well, this is what my life's going to be like now. You know, this is the level of success that I will always enjoy. And then suddenly 20 years later, you realize, actually, no, not necessarily. You know, you might fall off the mountain. And in fact, you almost certainly will. So it was just one of those things. I think books find us, you know, books find writers. You know, it wasn't as though I had lots of options. I had lots of ideas about what to do next. I didn't. I had just this one idea I wanted to write about this detective called Max Wolf, who lived in Smithfield opposite the meat market and worked in West End Central in Homicide and Serious Crime Command as a murder detective. I wanted to write about him, and I knew that he'd have a small daughter, and he'd have a dog called Stan, and I just had his world mapped out. But it was scary, and, you know, I hope I never have to do it again, because it was so much riding on it. It's not like, you know, when I wrote Man and Boy, you know, I wrote it as therapy. It didn't really need, you know, I hoped people would like it. I hoped that a few people would buy it. But I didn't need it to be a success. Whereas with The Murder Bag, which is the first Max Wolf book, I needed it to be a success. I needed it to be a success because I just gambled so much of my life and what I'd achieved on that. And, it, you know, thankfully it worked out. Sold it in 24 hours to a publisher who I'd never met, Penguin Random House. You know, went to number one, so it works out, but it's not something I look forward to doing again anytime soon. Thought Man was the second one, the third one was The Hanging Club, the fourth one, Die Last, came out a couple of weeks ago, so, and I'm working on the fifth now, so I'm doing six, and we'll see after that. I was just going to do three, you know, my model was really Stieg Larsson did three, and seemed to have quite an impact with that. I can certainly remember, you know, being on beaches 10 years ago and just everybody was reading Stieg Larsson. Everybody was reading it. And I thought, wow, I can remember going to a beach and everybody was reading Man and Boy. So, you know, so there's always one book there's reading or one writer they're reading and on the beach. So, yeah, so I thought I'd do three. I wanted to do three. And they were successful. So I'm doing another three. After that, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think it's, you know, it would be presumptuous for me to say there'll be more after that, because there has to be an appetite at the publishing house. There has to be an appetite among the readers, and there has to be some appetite in me too. So I don't know. 66 years, it feels like a lot. You know, I'm kind of, I do feel like a marathon runner, you know, entering the stadium on wobbly legs, you know, on the fifth book. I'm not sure I fancy another marathon.
Thanks, Tony. Man and Boy, narrated by Daniel Philpott, is TB12422. And we'll be hearing more about its sequel, Man and Wife, later in the show. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, and we'll have more after this.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. To join, telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk. RNIB is a membership organisation. To join, visit rnib.org.uk/membership.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
Welcome back to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. Gail Honeyman's debut novel, Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine, has been described as the hottest new release of 2017. The book sparked a bidding war between publishers that earned the author a seven-figure advance. With the book hitting the shelves last week, Robert Kirkwood wanted to find out more.
Thanks to the partnership between publisher HarperCollins and RNIB, available now at the same time as the print and commercial audio versions, is the talking book of Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine by Gail Honeyman. It's read by Catherine McCarran.
When people ask me what I do, taxi drivers, dental hygienists, I tell them I work in an office. In almost 9 years, no one's ever asked what kind of office or what sort of job I do there. I can't decide whether that's because I fit perfectly with their idea of what an office worker looks like, or whether people hear the phrase work in an office and automatically fill in the blanks themselves. Lady doing photocopying, man tapping at a keyboard. I'm not complaining. I'm delighted that I don't have to get into the fascinating intricacies of accounts receivable with them.
Gail Honeyman joined me in the RNIB Connect radio studios and told me about the book.
The book is the story of Eleanor Oliphant. She's quite an unusual young woman. She's 30 years old. She lives and works in Glasgow. She leads a very regimented life. She leads a very solitary life. She's someone who's learned how to survive, but maybe not how to live, if that makes sense. She has a chance encounter in the street with an old man who has an accident. She happens to be with a colleague, again by chance. And this one incident sets off a whole series of revelations which helps Eleanor develop and come to terms with things that have happened in her life, and we as readers find out why she is the way she is.
Mr. Gibbons is calling an ambulance, I said. So don't worry, you won't be lying here in the middle of the street for long. There's no need to be anxious. Medical care is completely free of charge in this country, and the standard is generally considered to be among the best in the world. You're a fortunate man. I mean, you probably wouldn't want to fall and bump your head in, say, the new state of South Sudan, given its current political and economic situation. But here in Glasgow, well, you've struck it lucky, if you'll pardon the pun. Raymond hung up and scuttled over. How's he doing, Eleanor? He said. Has he come round yet? No, I said, but I've been talking to him like you asked. Raymond took the man's other hand. Good old soul, he said. I nodded.
It's a slow drip. You're fed information. I remember feeling frustrated at one point. I wanted to read the social worker's report. So was that a very deliberate thing?
I wanted to try and keep the readers engaged. So I know that myself. It's when I'm reading other people's work, it's great when you feel, oh, I just have to keep reading on because I'm intrigued. There's something here that I'm not being told and I want to find out what it is. So I was trying my best to create that sort of set of circumstances in my book. Yeah, I hope it worked.
So certainly the first half of the book, it's a book about loneliness.
Yeah, I had read a newspaper article about loneliness a few years back, and one of the people they interviewed was a young woman who was in her late 20s. And she'd said she had a flat and a professional job and so on. But she said if she didn't make a special effort after she left work on Friday night, she sometimes the whole weekend would go by and she wouldn't speak to another human being until Monday morning. And I was a bit taken aback by that, because usually when we hear about loneliness, when it's discussed in the media, it's often in the context of older people, which is a huge issue, obviously. But I was intrigued that you don't usually hear about it with younger people, people in their 20s, early 30s. So I started to think about how someone could find themselves in that set of circumstances. And actually, when I thought about it, it wasn't at all difficult to think how that could come about. And so I wanted to try and show, I hope I've shown in the book, as Eleanor opens herself up to new experiences and to meeting new people, she starts to make connections, and things change so much for her because of that.
Let's slightly dance around spoiler material without giving anything away. I'm very aware we don't want to give anything away, but let's talk about mental health and the matter-of-fact way she reports on things with a sort of lack of emotion. It reminds me of other books that have featured characters who are maybe autistic or have Asperger's. Is there anything like that involved with Eleanor?
Personally, I didn't write her as a character with either of those conditions, but she does. I can see that there are some traits that you might think she shares with those, but no, I think it's more she's a survivor of some very challenging things without wanting to give away too much in the plot, and I think those have shaped her as an adult, and it's difficult to say without giving away the end. I think there's always the possibility of change.
Would you like Eleanor if you met her?
Oh, that's a great question. Would I like her? I hope I would be kind to her. She's not an easy person to like, and I was conscious of that when I was writing it. I was quite influenced by some 19th century novels, particularly Jane Eyre, when I was writing this, and rereading Jane Eyre again. I've read it several times in preparation for writing this book. I was struck as an adult by how Jane isn't a particularly likeable child when she's very young, and that in no way justifies the fact that people are cruel to her. But when she meets her aunt for the first time, I could kind of understand more as an adult that she isn't an endearing child, and she's not a people pleaser, she doesn't go out of her way to ingratiate herself with anyone. And that's all fine, as I say, and in no way justifies her subsequent mistreatment, but I was interested in that, and it was actually really fun to write a character who isn't a people pleaser, who is very direct, who appears not really to care very much what other people think about her. So as a writer, I had great fun trying to put that across in Eleanor. I hope I would like her, but then I know her better than anyone.
Other than Raymond, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
What is it about Raymond that you think drew them together?
I think Raymond is a kind person, and I think small acts of kindness, everyday acts of kindness, I don't mean extravagant acts of kindness, just little things every day can actually be quite transformative in the right at the right time with the right person. And he meets Eleanor at the right time, and he's not a judgmental person as well, which I think really helps. He's happy to take her as he finds her. Yeah, he's quite easygoing, he's not easily offended. And these are all really helpful, I think, when you meet someone who can inadvertently cause offence, like Eleanor.
And perhaps he's maybe a wee bit socially awkward himself.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually. I think, he has his issues in his life, as we all do. I think he's generally quite a content person. Yeah. That's a really good question, actually. I see him as being quite personable. He's very integrated in society, much more than Eleanor is or ever has been. He's been very blessed in that he's got a loving family. He had a very happy childhood. He's got some friends. He's socially integrated in a way that Eleanor hasn't for reasons that become apparent in the book. So maybe it's to do with that.
Right, Ben, I'll see you on Monday, he said. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. He turned to leave. Raymond, wait, I said. He turned back towards me, smiling. What is it, Eleanor? The Guinness, Raymond. It was £3.50. He stared at me. It's okay, I said. There's no rush. You can give it to me on Monday if that's easier. He counted out £4 coins and put them on the table. Keep the change, he said, and walked off. Extravagant. I put the money in my purse and finished my Magners. Emboldened by the apples, I decided to take a detour on the way home. Yes, why not? It was time for a spot of reconnaissance.
This is going to be a weird question, right? Trevor Horn, who was the sound of the 80s, was interviewed on radio about his single Video Killed the Radio Star. It wasn't released yet, but was asked by the presenter, how does it feel to have a big hit? Your book isn't released yet, but how does it feel to have a big hit?
What did Trevor Horn say?
He said, don't jinx it.
That's exactly what I'm thinking. I don't know, all I can do is keep my fingers and toes crossed.
Tell us about that auction in 2015.
Well, it still doesn't actually, even when I'm saying it now, when you're saying that, it still doesn't feel quite real. I'm still pinching myself about it all. I think the whole way through, as a writer, you sort of managing your expectations because it's really hard to get a book deal. It's really hard to get an agent, really hard to get a publisher and so on. So I just wanted to write this book. And I thought, when I get to the end, I just want to prove to myself I can write a whole novel. I can manage 80 or 90,000 words, kind of grapple with that shape of a piece of work. And if I get to the end, even if I just put it in a drawer and I never look at it again, at least I'll know, I wrote a novel. Mm. And then I entered the first three chapters, which was all I had written at that point, into a competition. It's called the Lucy Cavendish Award. It's for unpublished female writers over the age of 21. And you didn't have to have finished your book, which is why I was able to enter it, because I only had three chapters. And I was shortlisted for that competition. I didn't win, but I was shortlisted, which was a fantastic experience. And it turned out that one of the judges was a literary agent, and she approached me afterwards and said she'd really liked what she'd read, and could she represent me? And I said, yes, please, that would be fantastic. So that was a real confidence boost to keep going with it, because your confidence does ebb and flow as you're slogging away writing it all the way through. As I say, even though these great things had happened, I was still managing my expectations, because, like I say, the whole thing is really hard to get a book published. So when I finished it and my agent said she was going to submit it to publishers, even then I was thinking, well, we'll see, because even then lots of books get submitted by agents and still lots of them don't get anywhere. So when it turned out that, lots of them were interested and there was an auction.
What was it, eight publishers?
Eight publishers, yeah. And then the same thing happened in the States and then in other countries as well. So I think it's sold in 28 countries now, which is, again, that doesn't feel real when I tell you that.
And I've heard Reese Witherspoon's film company is looking into it as well.
That's right, yeah. She's acquired she's optioned the film rights. That just happened last week. So that's, again, a dream come true. So excited about that.
And for a debut novel as well.
I know. It's all I can say. I'm just pinching myself. I never in my wildest dreams expected anything like this to happen with it.
Why is she called Eleanor Oliphant?
I like the resonance of it, that just even if you knew nothing else about her apart from her name, it already starts, you can already kind of start to think about what kind of person she might be. I like the resonance of Eleanor all alone, Eleanor Rigby Oliphant, I think it's an old Scottish name. But it sounds a little bit like elephant, so I don't know. I just like there were all kinds of echoes and resonances in those two names together, which is why I chose it.
Now, in this edition of Read On, we're examining the titles, Chicklit and Manlit. What's your thoughts on those labels?
I'm not sure those labels are terribly helpful. I don't think it's helpful to narrow the audience for books, because who knows who's going to enjoy what type of story. I think most people are incredibly open-minded and receptive to all kinds of stories, and it's not helpful if things are in silos or if some avenues appear to be already closed off. I'm not sure that they're particularly helpful. But it's hard. I think everybody's looking for a shorthand way of describing things, but I agree with you. Sometimes it's maybe not very helpful, or it's counterproductive. I don't know.
Same with this book. People, we want to pigeonhole the books, but this could be a book about loneliness, about social awkwardness, could be a romance, could be... You know, it's all of these things.
There's a kind of a mystery as well.
Now, in the interests of spoilers, I'm going to beep some words from this next question, but... hopefully someone who's got to the end of the book has the same question and will know what I mean. At the end, why didn't and end up?
I wanted to leave readers to draw their own conclusion as to what happened next. I think the happiest outcome that Eleanor could have had, given where she started from in chapter one and where she ends up at the end, is that she's in a place where she might be able to think about having a relationship with someone. So the person, it may or may not be him.
There you go. Hopefully that answers the question without spoiling the book.
Good morning, Mr. Gibbons. My name is Miss Oliphant, and I am the finance clerk. My computer has stopped working, and I would be most grateful if you could see your way to repairing it today. Should you require any further details, you may reach me on extension 535. Thank you most kindly.
Eleanor Oliphant Is Completely Fine is available in print, in audio commercially, and in audio from RNIB Talking Books. For more information on the Talking Book service, which you can receive via CD, via USB stick, or download directly to your smart device via RNIB Overdrive, head to rnib.org.uk/library.
Thanks, Robert, and good luck to Gail Honeyman. I'm sure we'll be hearing plenty more from her in the future. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
They've found her, my lord!
Ned rose quickly. Omen or Lannisters?
It was Jory.
Daenerys Targaryen wed Khal Drogo with fear and barbaric splendour in a field beyond the walls of Pentos. The North went on forever. Tyrion Lannister knew the maps as well as anyone, but a fortnight on the wild track that passed for the King's Road up here had brought home the lesson that the map was one thing and the land quite another.
Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. Book 1 in A Song of Ice and Fire.
The courtyard rang to the sound of swords. Under black wool, boiled leather and mail, sweat trickled icily down John's chest as he pressed the attack.
Narrated by Tom Carter, it lasts 35 hours and 2 minutes. Talking Book number 19231.
Tell Jory to bring her here at once. I am sorry, my lord, Poole told him. The guards on the gate were Lannister men, and they informed the Queen when Jory brought her in. She's been taken directly before the King.
Also available are A Clash of Kings, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, and A Dance with Dragons. And many of them you can buy as a Daisy CD. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Welcome back to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. As we heard earlier, the sequel to Tony Parsons' Man and Boy, Man and Wife, is currently being recorded at the RNIB Talking Books studio. I caught up with narrator Dave John between takes. So, how are you enjoying Man and Wife?
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I'm in second day so far, so we're still in the early stages. But of course, I've read through the book and prepared it. And so it's one of these books because it's character led. And, you know, the main character is a kind of North London kind of guy. It's a good one for me. I can empathise with the main character.
I was going to say, you've got the perfect voice for it.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's why they gave me a call.
And have you read Tony Parsons' other books in the past?
Yeah, the first one, yeah.
That's Man and Boy?
Yeah, that's right.
And you enjoyed them?
Yeah, I have enjoyed them, yeah. What's good about, for as a reader, as in a narrator of a book, is that... you know, the main voice, the narrator voice, if it's easy to read, then it makes a big difference to us. If it comes off the page, if it's kind of written as kind of natural dialogue kind of style, that's really good for us. And that's what you find with Tony. He writes, you know, kind of very natural, authentic dialogue.
Yes, it's dialogue as it's spoken on the street, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yeah. So if you're just reading it, it's fine. But if you then start to try and narrate it and lift it off the page and read it as you go, it's almost sight reading with the audiobooks. Although you've prepared it, you know, things come up very quickly. And if it's written in that style that Tony uses, it makes our job a lot easier.
Have you narrated many other talking books over the years?
Yeah, I have. I think I'm on around 60, maybe more than that. I mean, I've lost count now, but I've been doing it for probably about 10 years, audiobooks. So,
do you have a favourite genre?
I've probably worked on more London crime than anything else, for obvious reasons. You know, all the London villainy, cops and robbers type thing. And if it's a really well written book, if it's good, you know, for as a narrator, if it's a good book and it's well written and it's character led, then they're the ones you kind of enjoy the most.
And do you listen to audiobooks in your spare time, or are you a paperback man?
I still like to read myself. I do listen to audiobooks, but more out of professional interest, listening to other readers, and because it's one of these jobs that when you're doing it, it's one thing, but you've got to understand that as a listener, what you're listening for and what you need as a listener. So it's important for us, I think, to listen to other readers and think, oh, that works really well. That style really works. That's a bit too quick. You know, that characterisation is a bit too much. It doesn't really need, you know, so it's as a kind of out of professional interest, you would listen to other readers. But I don't sit and listen to whole books myself.
And it's an exciting time to be a narrator. And more books are being published simultaneously in audio and print, aren't they?
Yeah, it is. I mean, since I started, I think there's been a real kind of boom in audiobooks. We hear about it a lot. We hear about all the books that are now available. Of course, they weren't downloads then. When I started recording books, it was mainly cassettes, believe it or not, and a lot of stuff for library. But commercially, I think they're more popular than they've ever been before. And as you say, they want everything recorded. So that's, you know, more work, hopefully, for us and more reading to do.
Keeps you out of trouble.
Yeah, keeps me off the street, yeah.
Indeed. From the audiobooks that you've listened to, do you have any particular, or that you've recorded yourself, do you have any particular favourites that stick in your mind?
That's a difficult one, because actually I did a series of Spanish, because I speak Spanish, so I did a few books that had a lot of Spanish in them, and they were English translations of Arturo Pérez Reverte, he was called. The Captain a la Triste stories set in the kind of back streets of Seville in Spain and Andalusia back in the 1700s. And they were just, because it was different for me, because I usually get the modern London contemporary stuff, which I enjoy. But I found this really interesting because I love Spain myself and Spanish culture and all the rest of it. So those I found really interesting. They were quite hard for me to do because they weren't my usual kind of style. But I found it fascinating. And they were so well written. The books are great. I mean, they're great old swashbuckling kind of adventure stories in Spain. A lot of Spanish characters and accents and things like that. So I found those, they were a challenge. But, I you know, they stick in my mind as things. I really enjoyed doing them.
Did he write The Club Duma as well?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great book, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, there's Purity of Blood, and it's all about, you know, the Spanish Inquisition and all around that period. So, you know, I'm fascinated with all history, but, you know, Spanish cultural history in particular. So they're great. They're a great read.
I'd love to ask you about how you prepare to make a talking book.
Yeah, this is key for us, actually. It's probably one of the most important parts of the process. When you get a book, the preparation is absolutely key. Some people have made the mistake of just reading the book and going in the studio, and it then takes much, much longer to record if you're not prepared, if you don't know what's coming, if you haven't got all your character voices practiced and rehearsed. It just doesn't work. And the other thing is, if you've got the time, I mean, it does take a lot of time, you can read the book just to get a shape and a feel and a knowledge of the book and see what the author is going for. And then you go back and read the book again and you mark up everything. Because often, as you know, you're reading a book and it will say something in speech marks, blah, 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 says Johnny, who's got an Irish accent at the end of the sentence. So you have to know that that's Johnny in his Irish accent before you get to the explanation. So you often have a colour scheme where you mark up Johnny is yellow, you know, Brenda is green. And so you have colour codes for each character. So maybe your lines are, you underline each sentence, or you have a little tab at the beginning. And we can do this nowadays on iPads. You can mark up everything on an iPad, or you can do it on paper with your little, you know, just make yourself a key so you've got little warnings of what's coming up. And if you do that job well, the preparation, studio becomes a whole different experience because you can really enjoy it more. You know what's coming. It can get on top of you, an audiobook, because it comes up quickly. You know, things come up, things happen quickly. Suddenly you're there, oh, I didn't realise I was coming. So if you get the shape of it and you know it really well, familiarity is so important.
And actually, every so often I'll hear the narrators swapping tips and stories in the green room, which is quite fascinating.
Absolutely, too. Yeah. And also, of course, in terms of your voice, you have to make sure your voice is properly warmed up, because you can lose, you know, so it can be a long day recording an audiobook. Not only in terms of the voice, which can get, you know, tired, but in terms of focus, concentration. If just you in the studio, if you're in there 4, 5, 6 hours sometimes,
wow.
You know, it can be, it's a hard day's work. You know, I'm not trying to get sympathy here. It's a great job. I love it. But, you know, there's more to it than I think most listeners would realise. It's one of those things, unless you've done it, you kind of don't quite understand what it takes.
Well, I think I speak for all the listeners when I say that the hard work is very much appreciated, because for many of us, the worst aspect of sight loss is actually losing the ability to read. So having somebody reading to us is just a lifeline.
Great. That's great to hear. That's what it's all about.
Thanks, Dave. And the talking book version of Man and Wife will be joining Tony Parsons' other books on the RNIB library shelves soon. One of the great joys of reading is swapping recommendations with others. When I've finished a great book, I can't wait to spread the word and find out what others are enjoying. Talking books is far more interesting than talking about the weather, which is why I look forward to your Educating Red suggestions. Back in February, author Sam Hepburn appeared on the show to talk about her new psychological thriller, Her Perfect Life. And when I asked her to recommend a book to broaden my literary horizons, she had no hesitation in directing me towards the shelves of 19th century fiction. It's Lady Audley's Secret by Mary Elizabeth Braddon. Like so many other Victorian classics, I knew the title but had never read the book. At university, it was just one of dozens of weighty tomes on an impossible reading list. Thereafter, I never got round to filling the gaps in my education. Until now. The novel was published in 1862, but like many other Victorian classics, it appeared first serialised in a weekly magazine. So there are plenty of cliffhangers in a plot that caused quite a stir. In fact, Lady Audley's Secret has been described as the most sensationally successful of all sensation novels.
Choose between the two alternatives, Mr. Audley. Shall you or I find my brother's murderer? He looked in her face and saw that her resolution was the fruit of no transient womanish enthusiasm which would give way under the iron hand of difficulty. Her beautiful features, naturally statuesque in their noble outlines, seemed transformed into marble by the rigidity of her expression. The face in which he looked was the face of a woman whom death only could turn from her purpose. "I have grown up in an atmosphere of suppression," she said quietly. "I have stifled and dwarfed the natural feelings of my heart until they have become unnatural in their intensity. I have been allowed neither friends nor lovers. My mother died when I was very young. My father has always been to me what you saw him today. I have had no one but my brother. All the love that my heart can hold has been centred upon him. Do you wonder, then, that when I hear that his young life has been ended by the hand of treachery, that I wish to see vengeance done upon the traitor?" "Oh, my God!" she cried suddenly, clasping her hands and looking up at the cold winter sky. "Lead me to the murderer of my brother, and let mine be the hand to avenge his untimely death." Robert Audley stood looking at her with awe-stricken admiration. Her beauty was elevated into sublimity by the intensity of her suppressed passion. She was different to all other women that he had ever seen. His cousin was pretty. His uncle's wife was lovely. But Clara Tallboys was beautiful. Niobe's face, sublimated by sorrow, could scarcely have been more purely classical than hers. Even her dress, Puritan in its grey simplicity, became her beauty better than a more beautiful dress would have become a less beautiful woman. "Miss Tallboys," said Robert after a pause, "your brother shall not be unavenged. He shall not be forgotten. I do not think that any professional aid which you could procure would lead you as surely to the secret of this mystery as I can lead you, if you are patient and trust me."
"I will trust you," she answered, "for I see that you will help me."
"I believe that it is my destiny to do so," he said solemnly.
The plot revolves around Audley Court, a country house estate in Essex, where the elderly baronet, Sir Michael Audley, has just married a much younger and very beautiful governess, Lucy Graham. Very little is known of the new Lady Audley's past. But when Sir Michael's nephew Robert arrives with his friend George Tallboys, Lucy begins to behave oddly, trying very hard to avoid them. George has recently returned from Australia, where he's made his fortune, only to discover that in his absence, his wife has died. He's distraught, and Robert brings him to Audley Court for a break. But once there, George too begins to act strangely. And then he disappears without a word. Suspecting foul play and convinced that Lady Audley is hiding something, Robert sets out to investigate. The plot owes much to the real-life Road Hill House murder of 1860. It too involved the marriage between a governess and a much older, richer man. Its lurid details fascinated and appalled the Victorian public, and inspired a slew of other Victorian sensation novels, such as The Woman in White and The Moonstone. The Road Hill case was brilliantly re-examined by Kate Summerscale in The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher. Indeed, the painstaking methods employed by Robert Audley as he criss-crosses the country interviewing witnesses and gathering evidence against his suspect mirror those employed by Mr. Witcher. It's a fast-moving investigation that makes full use of the newly built railway network. But while on one level it's an early example of detective fiction, the book's themes run deeper than that. It reflects contemporary anxieties about the effects of the Industrial Revolution. Rapid urbanisation and the spread of the railways brought huge social change. People had never been so mobile or so anonymous. The book plays on fears about stranger danger. Its opening paragraph paints a perfect picture of Audley Court before an outsider came to live in its midst.
It lay low down in a hollow, rich with fine old timber and luxuriant pastures, and you came upon it through an avenue of limes, bordered on either side by meadows, over the high hedges of which the cattle looked inquisitively at you as you passed, wondering perhaps what you wanted, for there was no thoroughfare, and unless you were going to the court, you had no business there at all.
The outside world brings change and misfortune with it. But the book also questions the wisdom of a society that sets such store by ancestry and appearance, and that seeks to put women on pedestals.
Good heavens, exclaimed Robert, as he watched the merry party of equestrians until they disappeared under the archway. What does all this mean? How charmingly she sits her horse. What a pretty figure, too, and fine, candid, brown, rosy face. But to fly at a fellow like that without the least provocation, that's the consequence of letting a girl follow the hounds. She learns to look at everything in life as she does at 6 feet of timber or sunk fence. She goes through the world as she goes across country, straight ahead and over everything. Such a nice girl as she might have been, too, if she'd been brought up in Fig Tree Court. If I ever marry and have daughters, which remote contingency may heaven forfend, they shall be educated in paper buildings, take their sole exercise in the temple gardens, and they shall never go beyond the gates till they are marriageable, when I will take them straight across Fleet Street to St. Dunstan's Church and deliver them into the hands of their husbands.
By exploring the motivations and psychology of her characters and the society that they live in, Braddon gives extra punch to the questions that she raises about sanity and imprisonment. At times I forgot that I was reading a novel written over 150 years ago. The prose rattles along at a great pace, the dialogue is spot on, and the characters have the full range of faults and foibles that you'd expect to find in one of today's historical page-turners. This impression was only enhanced by Jenny Coversack's brilliant narration on the talking book version that I downloaded from Overdrive. Using a full palette of voices, she brought the characters vividly to life. In case you haven't guessed the ending, I loved this book. Perhaps I should have read it for my English degree, but it just goes to prove that it's never too late to catch up on your education. My thanks to Sam Hepburn for a brilliant recommendation. Lady Audley's Secret is available in various formats from the RNIB library, including as TB20551. So that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Tony, Gail and Dave, and to everyone who's been in touch about the books that you've been enjoying and your ideas for titles that I should read. Next week we'll examine how reading can change your mind. So, if you've got any suggestions for titles we should choose, or want to get in touch about anything you've heard or read, I'm just an email away. Until then, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.